and good morning. You're listening to Dig in the Dirt here on the stations of Coast Community Radio. I'm Kate Brister. I'm sitting in this morning for Ann Goldine. And this morning, we welcome Linda Brim of Brim's Farm and Gardens. I am so happy to welcome Linda. Brim's Farm and Garden has been voted the best nursery by the Daily Historian for 5 consecutive years. And today we're going to talk about a wide range of subjects, including what to plant in the fall, preparing your garden, what the weather might be like this winter, and just how to make the most of our garden soils through this crazy summer and crazy fall. Linda, good morning. Welcome. Thank you so much for coming.
Good morning. Thank you, Kate.
So today on our topic, we're seeing a change in the weather. We've gone from an incredibly dry, weird summer to now we're coming into our fall. We're getting ready to winterize our gardens. What have you got going on now at Brim's that you're kind of featuring and talking about for this time of the year?
Well, everybody is really trying to reclaim their garden and make it look beautiful again because the summer drought really did take a huge toll on a lot of things that we assumed would do okay. So people are replacing plants and dressing up with annuals and perennials, the cabbages and kales and mums, pansies, violas, and a lot of the long-blooming perennials. People are plugging back in. But beyond that, it's really important to take a look around the garden and see what's bit the dust, because I was really battling the drought myself, and I know a lot of other people were, and especially if you traveled, you're probably going to nose around the garden and see that things have really fried that would normally do okay. So
what seemed to be particularly susceptible? Do you know this year?
Anything that put on a lot of blooms or had very thin leaves, you know, things that have a waxy coated leaf like your laurels and, you know, the fuzzy leaf plants, they don't necessarily do as poorly as other plants. Like I had a oxydendron in a pot that I'm pretty sure is not going to come back.
Even in a pot, you couldn't.
Well, because it was in a pot, it didn't have that full expansion of root system to do okay in a drought. So things that are on a slope or rocky, sandy soil, plants that were under the cover of conifers or, you know, you would think that the shade would actually give them better survivability, but that morning dew actually will help a lot of plant material carry on because it will absorb the moisture in the air right at dawn that happens. The dew point will settle on the plants. And then the overhanging foliage will actually absorb that prior to the plants underneath getting it. So it's not like a downpouring rain where they're going to get filtered water and the soil is also going to be soaked. Plants in shade probably also suffered if you didn't water. And for people that have long established landscapes and they've got a really well set plan for how to take care of their watering or they've got sprinkler systems, you're probably going to have some unhappy surprises. Other things that we'll notice later on in the spring will be things that were forming buds in the late summer, like rhododendrons and azaleas and even hydrangeas. A lot of the spring blooming plants are probably going to show up empty-handed with no blooms. And you'll be able to tell that pretty quickly because the buds will all be brown and shriveled up. And the plants will do that naturally to protect the rest of the plant, so their survivability goes up if they sacrifice the blooms.
Talk a little bit about rhododendrons in this situation, because those are bushes and plants that we see all over our area that seem to thrive everywhere.
They do.
And yet you say they might have some trouble this year.
They might. And, you know, the locations that weren't watered because the homeowner or the landscape person just assumed that they would do okay. They've always done okay. And, they've never needed water in the past. And then in the spring, people will start phoning in on the phone lines. We'll get them in the nursery. You know, what's going on with my rhododendron? It didn't bloom and it looks like it's dying back. They'll see buds on the plant that are brown and shriveled and they'll think those are the leaves that are supposed to emerge. And sometimes the leaves won't even emerge, but generally what you'll see is the buds have browned and have shrunken up.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so they've aborted the buds. They will not bloom. You might have just a real tiny sprinkling of blooms around the plant, but not robustly. Like, they usually clothe themselves in blooms all over.
So where is that plant energy going, Linda? If they're not able to bloom, they're not able really to thrive and flourish the way we're used to seeing them, but the plant's got some energy. Is it just all being forced into the...
It's reserving it in the roots and in the leaf tissue. They do have somewhat of a waxy coated leaf. So the energy that they expend and the amount of water that's required to get that bud to open just isn't there. So without the water, the bloom tissue just cannot form properly.
Mm-hmm.
So they just abort.
So what do you recommend now if homeowners have seen this? They're looking kind of, you know, there's spotted leaves. They're blooms that are immature and have just died before thriving. Do you recommend that people kind of cut it back through the winter, or
if they're really looking ragtag, like they scorched in addition to they're seeing the buds aborted, cutting them back certainly won't hurt them. The plant will grow out of it if it's got enough stores in the root system. So especially if you recently had planted in a new landscape and the plants were looking pretty rugged, I would go ahead and cut back the material that looks bad, because that will help the plant in the spring when the new buds emerge. It won't have as much tissue to try and rejuvenate. I mean, it will focus its energy down low rather than leave tissue up high. You're still gonna end up with a leggy plant that's not
mm-hmm.
gonna look very good.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, you know, just go ahead and sacrifice the growth that you started with and cut it back down. You'll have a nice compact bushy plant that's gonna be nice and green, and the following year you'll have some buds. Hopefully.
So you think maybe in one whole season that plant could recuperate again?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, rhododendrons are fabulously resilient.
Very hardy, aren't they?
They are not just cold hardy, but they have excellent energy stores for being cut back. And doing it at the right time so that you don't have a lot of sticks and empty stubs. If you time it so that you do it right in the early spring, late winter,
mm-hmm.
they will emerge pretty quickly without having to look at the stubs. But that said, if you... have the plants in an area that's sloped in poor soil, you're probably going to want to look at putting some organic matter in the soil now, because that will give it more resiliency. If we continue to have really dry summers, then you'll set the plant up for better success.
Okay.
With more organic matter.
Talk just a minute, Linda, about the difference between mulching and organic matter and the need to keep, particularly around the bases of trees and bushes and shrubs, clean. That conflict between you need to mulch, you need to lay this material down, and yet under trees, under certain bushes, things like that, it can get too much matter, can actually interfere with the plant, can't it?
A really good example of that was when the master gardeners first started working on the fairgrounds. There are several large Norway maples, the red leaf maples, are absolutely stunning, that looking at it, we're like, why aren't those trees thriving? They should be absolutely gorgeous, and they just were awful. So we started nosing around in there and dug out around the base of the plants, and what the landscape folks up there that were doing the maintenance had done was buried the crown of the tree, the crown of the root base, under several inches, you know, more than half a foot of bark dust. And what was happening was the roots were actually smothering, and the trees had very wimpy tops, very wispy growth, very few leaves. You saw more of the scaffolding than you saw of leaves.
Wow.
And now if you go out there and look at those trees, where Walt's actually working, that Walt is the garden overseer.
This is
and
wonderful. Walt John, master
gardener. Slave. Slave to the garden. He loves it, though. He's looking at doing some serious tree surgery to balance those trees in the landscape so that the size of the limbs is in proportion to the size of the garden and the way the garden's used.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really been turned around. So yes, a really good point. You can way overdo it when you're mulching. So Generally, when you want to lay down a good top dressing of mulch or bark, you know, it doesn't take very much of the feeding mulch. So that would be something like a really good compost, an aerobic compost to feed. And I wouldn't get too crazy with more than half an inch. It doesn't take very
much.
Not
more than half an inch. That is something.
Yeah. And then if you're going to put bark on top of that, you're going to put a very thin layer of bark, just enough to dress it up.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you may end up with about an inch of mulch.
Now, this is something that I have heard people be a little bit confused about, is the use of the bark cosmetic, where they think that it's actually doing some kind of composting or doing, you know, it's providing the compost with the bark dust. But that's not so, is it? It's primarily an ornamental. It will break down, though, at some point.
Initially, yes, it will provide feed because compost happens and bugs will move in. You'll get all kinds of beneficial soil biota coming in and eating that bark and breaking it down, but it won't feed right away. So if you think about the way it happens naturally, and we talked about this last year, so forgive me if you're hearing a rerun speech on leaf litter, but the leaf litter is how nature intended the plants to be fed. The leaf litter falls, the bugs move in, they start breaking down the leaf litter, funguses, bacteria, they start digesting everything. And then the fungal connections at the root tips break all of the chemicals down into a form that the tree or the shrub or the perennial, whatever, can use to take it up as food for the plant. So we speed the process along when we put on compost. It's not necessary, but a lot of people don't like the look of the leaf litter. They want to keep it raked up and they want a more uniform look. So a lot of the composts are, they're beautiful. They're dark and have the same texture. So you can get a really good zen look by putting all of one color and texture down on your borders.
But again, you're saying not much more than half an inch.
Yeah,
eh?
Yeah. And it depends on how big the tree is, obviously. Mm-hmm. The bigger the tree, the more mulch. But I've actually cooked trees when I was a very young homeowner, didn't know anything. We planted some maples, and I thought, well, I want to keep the grass from coming up around these trees. And my husband was very famous for skinning the bark with a weed whacker. So we started piling up the grass clippings around the base of the trees to keep the grass from coming up. And boy, did it ever, because it was so hot in there that it actually cooked the grass out. But over time, it actually killed one of the trees.
For heaven's
before
sakes.
We figured out what was going on. So, I reached in there to pull some of it off when I realized it was too deep, and it was hot. It was very hot to the touch. So, you want to use some common sense when you're putting that stuff down. And if you buy bagged, there's a chart usually on there that will tell you how thick to cover. Or ask a master gardener.
Ask a master gardener.
Saturday is an excellent opportunity for that.
Indeed. Why don't we talk about that for just a second?
Yes.
On October 17th, where the master gardeners are doing a winterizing your garden workshop. Plan, plant, prep, and prune. Do's, don'ts, and shoulds for the fall. That's quite
awesome.
That's just about everything,
yes.
What to do, what not to do, and everything in between. That's being held at the Columbia Pacific Heritage Museum in Ilwaco. Linda, what's the number one thing that we can do? If you can't attend the full symposium, what's the number one thing people need to do to winterize a garden? Is it cleaning? Is it rearranging plants or replanting or anything? What's your number one tip for this time of the year?
Pick the number one tip. The number one tip would be get off the couch and get out there, because, you know, it's this weekend, if you're working and you don't like gardening in the rain and you're not poking around out there, it's really easy to just kind of let the garden gate shut behind you and hibernate. But boy, the work that you do now is going to make your life so much easier when you start back up in the spring. And most people that are really avid gardeners are out there all year anyway. So I think slug baiting right now and eradicating as many of the adults that are in the process of laying eggs for next year's army of slugs that are coming out.
Oh, how wonderful.
In my garden right now, I'm really on the slug baiting, because I've noticed that they've really emerged with a vengeance.
Okay.
But everybody's going to have a different, the number one thing.
Yeah, everybody kind of has their way of doing slug baiting. And we're going to talk about deer eradication in just a minute, too. But Linda Brim, how do you slug bait? What do you do? Are you copper? Are you quarries? Are you a mix? What do you do?
This is really cruel and rough, but on a hot day, I throw them out in the parking lot and watch them sizzle.
Mm-hmm.
I mostly use my shoes and stomp on them. If I'm walking through and I'm in a hurry and I see one, I'll just stomp on it.
But talk about at night when you know those little critters are coming out
baits,
and whatever. Okay.
I use baits. And I rotate. Where there's no pets, I really like the deadline because it works really fast. And I like rotating between the metaldehyde, which is going off the market. Which is unfortunate, but that's been one that I've been using up, and that's very, very effective for me. And then I rotate with the iron phosphate, and that is a lot safer for critters. If they eat enough of it, if you're not applying it correctly and they eat enough of it, yes, they could get a bellyache. It's not going to kill them like the metaldehyde will kill.
Is that why it's being taken off the market,
yeah,
particularly?
Probably.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. EPA changes the rules every year, so it's something you just got to stay up on.
Mm-hmm.
But people are still selling stock that they have, but it's not going to be replenished as far as I know right now.
Okay.
Then the other product that I really like to use liberally is the cinnamon spray.
Cinnamon spray.
To my horror, I'm out of right now because I wanted to spray last night. We did all of the cabbage and kale and hosed them down. They were full of aphids starting up.
Wow.
So I actually went through and gave everything we had a car wash in the nursery and just hosed, because you can kill those aphids pretty quickly with a water jet spray. And so then I had to go back through with the slug bait, and I wanted to spray them once they were dry with the cinnamon oil. And
mm-hmm.
the cinnamon oil will kill them pretty quickly on contact. It's
excellent.
Amazing stuff. Yeah.
I love that. Talk to me about cinnamon oil.
Well, the cinnamon oil smells fabulous. You know, it's almost like a snickerdoodle in the garden. And you just spray it on the plant material, and it stops them in their tracks.
Well, for now, is this something you sell commercially, or is it something one creates?
It's available. No, it's available off the shelf. And Dr. Earth has a cinnamon oil, and the other one, I can't remember the company that makes it, but we carry both of them, but I'm out of stock right now. I need to reorder,
mm-hmm.
so I got to get
mm-hmm.
some in the store. It's a really nice non-toxic product to use.
Boy, that sounds fascinating.
Effective.
And again, you've used it on leaves for aphids.
Yeah,
what else?
I love it on the hostas and on Ligularia, the ones that they just, you know, you put them out there, you're ringing the dinner bell for them. You do have to get up underneath the leaves and around the ground as well.
Mm-hmm.
To really stop them if you've got a bad infestation. But it does work very, very well. The slugs will lay their eggs under the ground or in your pots. And if you pull your plant material out of the pot and you see a bunch of little white BBs or translucent BBs, those are the slug eggs. So if we can stop those eggs or stop the adults before they lay their eggs, we're going to have many, many fewer, much, much fewer slugs showing up in the spring.
Much better, much better. And talk to me now, before we leave the subject of winterizing your garden, we've talked about your number one tip for that. What should we not do that you see people doing? Is there anything that you see people kind of
for slug baiting
doing? Well, for anything that happens at this time of year. They're talking about
leaves. Please don't burn your leaves.
There you go. Don't burn your leaves.
Don't burn your leaves. You know, it's just so foul to smell leaves burning, unless you're using them for fire starter or something, but you can bag them up and take them down to the recycle center for free.
Or use them as...
or mulch with them.
All right.
Yeah. I mean, that's just a personal thing that I've never understood why people burn their leaves.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, going back to the slug baiting, I think the number one mistake people make when they use slug bait is they use way too much. Deadline does not mean spray, you know, line put a ring around your plants with the line of deadline, because if your animals do come in and they start lapping that stuff up, they're going to get a snootful and really get sick. So it's a drop about every 12 inches. And with the iron phosphate.
And that's truly effective.
Oh, yes. Salt and pepper. A few of the little particles in a square foot is all it takes. You don't need to put a whole bunch of it out there.
Talk to me about salt and pepper. Were you using that as a descriptive
phrase,
or do you also use salt and pepper as a deterrent?
Well, you could use...
I use salt.
Salt to kill slugs, and a lot of people do that. They go around with a salt shaker, and they just sprinkle it on, and it does dissolve them. And pepper, not the pepper flakes, but... You can use, if you grew some really hot habaneros or the hot Thai peppers or the Anaheim chilies, whiz those up in the blender and spray that on your plant, and that will stop rabbits, deer, dogs. It will burn. It doesn't last for very long, but so salt and pepper, good, free.
I think that's a great idea.
Garden.
And I love that it's more organic and more natural and everything else. So
while
you said the word deer, let's talk about our friends, our four-footed friends that are so lovely to see.
And they're so abundant, becoming more and more so. It's wonderful to have them in the garden. But you don't want all your hard labor ending up in their tummies. And especially when you've been waiting and waiting and waiting for a tulip to open or a rosebud to bloom, it's really frustrating. And they can wipe out blueberry crops and a lot of other crops, apples. They're vermin in that respect. So in doing some research for the talk this morning, I found some pretty comical ways people are keeping deer out of the garden. And one of them was this gentleman had set up you could use tuna cans. He was using cat food cans, and he had tied a 12-pound fishing line to these tuna cans, and then he had placed them on top of a 5-gallon bucket and run a trip line at 3 feet. And he had done this around the garden. And what was happening for him was the deer would hit the trip line and the cans would fall off of the 5-gallon bucket and scare them away. And he swore by this. I'm sure it did scare him away, but then I'm thinking, well, if the deer knock the line down, then won't that just open the door for other deer later on in the evening? So I'm not sure how successful he was long term, but he thought that was the greatest thing since sliced bread. So,
well, noise deterrence
it does.
can work, except that if you have a group that now around my home last year, we had a group of a mother and her little babies, and once they got used to our noise and got used to us, that was the end of that. I went out and clapped and shouted and sang at the top of my lungs, and they just smiled.
Yeah, they really do need to be you got to change whatever you're doing up, because they will become just so nonchalant about whatever's happening. You know, they might hear the cans rattle once or twice, and after that, they're like, well, nothing happened. Nobody died. I'm going in for it. You know, they'll just say, I'm making a run for it. The one that I did see that was posted by the University of Michigan was a gentleman who was growing blueberries. And he was saying that they actually had done a several-year run of how many pounds they were getting. They were getting 1,400 pounds of blueberries off of this several-acre blueberry crop field. And the deer were becoming quite a problem. So when he got rid of his cows, he was able to refence everything with an 8-foot tall fence that was placed at a slant. And I couldn't find in there what grade the slant was at. But then he took his line, he put barbed wire on the top, and then he used straight wire in rows of 7 all the way down to 1 foot off the ground. And it's slanted so that the deer will not go into it. And once they get in, they usually figure out how to get out, but they don't like getting into small spaces. So, it was very, very effective. He actually used a wooden prop that was just cantilevered on there with a bolt. He just bolted it on, and he could straighten it up, lift it up if he had to mow underneath it. It was very, very portable. And that looked like it was really an ingenious fencing application.
And
that
remind
would work.
Me again, how big an area was he trying to save with that?
Oh, several acres.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And he had he costed it out at 40 cents a foot, which is really cheap. That is super, super cheap. He had used a combination of wood posts and T-posts. So that if you want to track that one down, it was the University of Michigan. And I just put in deer fencing.
Mm-hmm.
And that one popped up. A lot of the sprays are very effective, but you have to rotate those. And they work on the fact that deer can't find the plant material that you want to protect if whatever they're smelling is obnoxious. So most of them use blood, egg.
It's protein-based material, isn't it? Kind of.
No,
like...
not all of them. And actually, there's several now that are very, very effective that are completely plant-based. The egg-based ones work really well. The blood-based ones work well to start, and then they kind of drop off dramatically. So most of them, you have to apply them every week until you get up to the first month, and then after that, you apply it every 2 weeks. So you want to rotate and do one for several months and then stop and then switch to a completely different one. We're bringing one in that works. It's plant-based and it smells like mint. So that will really be attractive to all the people that have deer issues, but they cannot stand the smell of like liquid fence. We had another one called This One Works that we can't get anymore that was also equally stinky. It had Bitrex in it, which was a bittering agent, but really the smell is what's working in most of the other ones. And then the other items that people are using with very good success are the motion activator sprinklers. And if you move those around, you'll get really good results with those because they make a sound. They jolt the deer out of their socks when they get hit with this water spray because it comes on just instantly when the deer approaches it.
Oh, so now that's interesting. I have not heard of this before. So it's like
called a scarecrow.
A scarecrow.
Yeah. It's a little sprinkler head that has a little scarecrow face on it.
Oh,
they're kind of
cute. And it's motion sensitive, you say. And so as soon as the deer steps into the area, then they get that something blast.
And they're chased off.
Wonderful.
And it does a 360. So if there's more than one deer, it will get them all and they run off. But if you don't move it, they will get pretty wise to how far that sprinkler covers and they will walk around it. So you have to make sure that it's not in the same place for very long. Also, I wanted to mention on Saturday morning at 9 o'clock at the store, Oregon State is offering, I'm going to teach a pruning class through Oregon State. So if you're interested in signing up for that, I believe there's still space. You can call the extension office at 503-325-8573 to sign up for that.
Well, that's great. A lot going on. So down at Brim's Farm and Garden, an activity, say again, when?
Pruning class Saturday at 9 o'clock, Saturday, just for weather, because we're going to be outside.
Very good. So you can do pruning at Brin's, or you can go to Il Waco at the Pacific County Heritage Museum for winterizing your garden with the Master Garden, and you can do both.
Yep.
This has been an absolutely great half hour. Linda Brim of Brim's Farm and Garden, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kate.
For being my guest today. I do appreciate it.
My pleasure.